Let's have a meeting.
My name is David, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, at the NAB Club. Where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, with 1 year or more of sobriety, tells his or her story.
I'm Troy, and I'm an alcoholic. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes, in their own language and from their own point of view, the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeaker.org desperately in need will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. It's an honor to be here tonight and be able to introduce this man. You know, I don't care whether you've been here in this program a week or many years, you will meet people along the way that will change your life. A good friend of mine from St. Simon's, Bob Trednick, a great alcoholic, says that is God with skin. And Wes Houser is one of those people that changed my life that I met along the way that made a definite difference for me. I love this man. He is one of the original persons. He is the original person that brought me into this program. I remember clearly the day I told him, Wes, I believe that I need to be going to AA. He said, that's right. You sure do. And he's the person that introduced me to my sponsor, who is my same sponsor now 16 years later. He made a difference in my life. I know you'll find his story as inspiring as it has been for me. You know, he knows everyone in my family. I've been in one of his weddings, I know for sure. I introduced you to Wes Houser, a great alcoholic.
I'm Wes, alcoholic. Feeling glad to be here. Glad to be sober. NAB is a special place to me. I've been coming here since I was, I think, 13 years old. So it's about 1989 or so. So, and I'll get into that, how I first came to get to NABA and in my story. And it's a short one. You know, I was thinking about it the other day. I really didn't have very long periods of drinking compared or using compared to most people. But I got to where I needed to get, and fortunately, you know, I'm here. So I'll talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I was born in 76 up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to a you know, mom and a dad that were together at that time. My dad was going to medical school up there and had just graduated, and my mom was also finishing up school and kind of working and supporting all of us. And, you know, when I was 3 years old, we moved down to Atlanta because my mom and dad were having trouble, and my dad's mother lived in Rome, Georgia. So he moved us down, tried to get them to work it out, didn't work out. So my dad moved to Atlanta, we stayed in Rome, Georgia. And you know, my memories of my childhood were pretty happy. You know, I had a great mother. I didn't see my dad much, but my mom took care of all our needs. Didn't have a lot of money, but had what we needed. We, you know, went to a Catholic school from kindergarten through eighth grade. I played sports. I was never great at anything. Just kind of, you know, good at a lot of different things, but not nothing special. And you know, I had a happy life early on. So, you know, I think my first kind of exposure, I think it was to drugs. It was to my story starts with alcohol and ends with alcohol, but there's some drugs in there. Was to marijuana, and I was scared of it. You know, I was really, really scared to when somebody tried to get me to smoke it. So I passed on that. I think I was about 11 years old, and then you know, I was always like a kid who was trying to make money or do something, so it was either cutting grass or, you know, doing something. And I started, you know, buying and selling marijuana, and then, you know, I started figuring out I could put a little oregano in there and make a little bit more money. So I started doing that, and you know, I did that for a little while, never drank, never touched drugs. And the first experience I had with drinking or anything was I was 13 years old, and you know, I was kind of starting to hang out with some different people now. I played guitar, started playing guitar when I was 8, took lessons and started playing in these little, you know, little rinky-dink bands with people. And a lot of those guys drank and used, and they were older than me. And I ended up meeting a guy who, he didn't like being in Rome either. I didn't like being in Rome. He was 15. I was 13. We decided we were going to leave Rome together and go out. And, you know, he would get us out, get us where we're going, and I would, you know, play the guitar and make a lot of money and support us. And so just a bad thought, it was delusional. So we were able to, he stole, I think it was like $1,500-$1,600 from his dad, took his dad's van, came and picked me up, and our goal was to get to Los Angeles. And we actually made it. We actually made it out there. So we ran away, made it out to Los Angeles, ended up in Long Beach, and then, you know, we didn't really know what to do. You know, our plan, again, was for me to play music and get in a band, but we had no kind of real way of doing that. So the first drink I ever had was out there. We had gotten a hotel room. It was back a long time ago in the 80s where, you know, I just wasn't as, he looked a little bit older, so he was able to go in and get the room. There, you know, wasn't as much emphasis, I think, on IDs and things like that. And I don't remember what it was, but I remember it tasted awful. And, you know, I drank it, and I got really drunk. And then that was actually, too, the first time I went out and tried to drive. So I went, and I got in the car, and I was going to go to the store and get a pack of cigarettes. And, you know, I didn't know how to drive, so I started kind of bumping into different cars. And it was at nighttime, and there was a guy that came out, started yelling at me because I hit his car. And you know, my friend came out and was pointing for me to just get out and go over there. And the guy, you know, stood in front of the car and said, "If you're going to get out here, you're going to have to run me over." And then I ran him over. So, and I got my friend. We took off, and we were able to kind of get on the road undetected. And we drove to Las Vegas next. And I think it took us another day or so just with stops to get there. And back then, Las Vegas was a place where it wasn't kid-friendly. Like these days, I go out there a good bit for my work, and you know, you see kids running around the casinos with their parents, not in the casinos, like the gaming part, but you can walk through. But back then, you couldn't even go in unless you were 18. And so everywhere we tried to go, they turn us down. And you know, we were getting in a pretty bad situation because we were running through our money. $1,500 doesn't go that far, you know, when you're kids and you're spending it on stupid stuff. And the last bit of our money, my friend met a lady of the night out there, and she got the last of it. The next day we were trying to figure out what we were going to do. We had, I think, like $15, $16 worth of quarters left and change. And we were at a gas station, and there was a cop that pulled in. So I, for whatever reason, I thought like every cop in the country was looking for us. And nobody was really looking for us. Our parents had put out a missing persons report rather than a stolen car. And later the cop told me if I hadn't stood in front of the license plate and looked suspicious, he never would have noticed us. So after we left the store, he got behind us, started pulling us over, and thankfully, I had some sense because the guy I was with handed me this big Rambo knife and told me to stab the cop. And, you know, I didn't, definitely was not about to do that. I wasn't that kind of, you know, kind of kid. So, you know, they took us to a detention center, told us, and called our parents, told us they could either leave us there for 2 weeks in YDC and they'd get us back, or they or the youth authority or whatever it's called out there, or they could fly us back. So both our parents flew us back, and as soon as my friend got back, he was able to go out, and you know, his dad didn't really punish him. He just went home, went out and did whatever he wanted to do. And as soon as I got back home, my parents said we were going to see somebody, and then we actually ended up at Ridgeview. So that was my first experience. And I'd only drank once at this time, so I didn't really have, I didn't have a story or whatever. I didn't have any type of history with drugs and alcohol. So they put me in the middle part just to kind of figure out what was going on with me. And that was back when Ridgeview and the 18 and under were separated into like a psychiatric and a drug. Or no, they were combined, sorry. So they were together. And after being in there for a little bit, you know, I just wanted to fit in. And I had a roommate who you know, done drugs. He was a kid probably my age, 13, 14. And so I'd tell stories, just lie about, you know, doing these drugs and drinking and stuff like that. And then he went and told on me to the counselors and said, look, this kid said he didn't do drugs, but he's telling me he did all these drugs. And they came and asked me, and I just told a lie and, you know, lied and said I had done it and ended up getting treatment for a couple of months. And I never drank. You know, I just sat in groups, lied the whole time. You know, and went to another year of aftercare for that, you know, and I think I just felt like I belonged. I felt like I got along with alcoholics and addicts or, you know, the people I was around. And that was my first experience to AA, too, because when I got back, I had to go to meetings a couple times a week. I was still 13. I think I had just turned 14. And went to meetings, and I had to go to aftercare once a week for a year. So ended up doing that, and I stayed sober for, you know, the next couple of years. So like I said, 13 to 15, I still didn't mess with anything. And then I got into, you know, smoking a little pot and drinking a little bit more with friends on the weekend. And, you know, never really seriously got into it. It was at that time I, like, you know, started feeling, I guess, that feeling of just not belonging, not fitting in. Even though I had friends, I just, there was like a kind of an emptiness inside. And I noticed that when I drank alcohol, that would go away, you know. And so on the weekends, I felt normal. And I would, you know, ended up being just kind of a weekend guy, drink, do LSD, smoke weed, stuff like that on the weekends. And started getting back into selling drugs. And I just wasn't a good drug dealer, so I got caught pretty quickly. And then, you know, I had a choice of moving to Atlanta with my father, or I can't remember what else it was, or staying around with my mom. So I moved to Atlanta, which they thought would be a better environment for me. You know, my dad was a lot stricter and would keep an eye on me. So what it ultimately ended up doing, because I had a kind of a probation group that I transferred to up here, was it exposed me to more kids doing more bad things, you know, and just a lot more stuff I could get into. And, you know, that feeling, and when I came up here, I stayed sober again for a little bit, you know, from 15 to 17. And I remember some of those were just like, usually every day after school, I would just feel this terrible, terrible feeling. I don't think I would ever have committed suicide, but I just felt like I didn't want to be alive. I didn't want to wake up. I didn't want to be living the life that I was living. And it was just every day. And again, I noticed on the weekends when I would, you know, use and drink and do things with my friends, that would go away. And, you know, I got back into kind of dealing a little dope at that time, just weed. And, you know, everything was fairly normal. I was going to school, making good grades. You know, I made terrible grades my first few years and kind of turned it around. And 11th and then 12th grade. And, you know, I started kind of messing with chemicals. So I started selling. I wouldn't do cocaine, but I would sell it, you know, and some of these other things. And I remember just being disgusted by what I saw when I look at other people doing cocaine or meth or the things that I sold. And, you know, I'd say, you know, I just would plan, you know, promise myself I would never be like that. I would never do that. And, you know, I think throughout that time, I didn't have really any more trouble. And I remember when I was 18 and I was about to graduate, it was a couple months, maybe 3 months before I was about to graduate, it's the first time I did cocaine. And yeah, I never felt that at peace in my life. And, you know, it just transcended everything I'd ever done. And you know, and the downfall was pretty quick. I went to you know, I quit high school right then, and I just went into, I was selling drugs full time. And now that I was messing with chemicals, things started getting more and more violent. And, you know, kind of with my interactions with the selling side. And I remember something my dad used to always tell me, just based on my behavior and his interactions with me, you know, just tell me, one day you're going to get into trouble where I just cannot help you. And I'm not going to be able to get you out, because he was always getting me out of this or that. And, you know, that turned out to be true. But throughout that 18 to 19 year, I was kind of in and out of jail. You know, it'd start with a week here, then it went to, you know, 2 weeks, then, you know, 30 days. And then I think the longest at that time was 60 days. And, you know, it was just more of the same. I just went downhill really fast when I started kind of mixing and matching the chemicals and the pills and stuff like that with my alcohol use. And, you know, at that time, too, I started, you know, robbing my customers. So, and you run out of customers real fast doing that. So, you know, that was just kind of the progression. And like they say, I've heard a lot, is that, you know, you can't lower your standards enough to meet your behavior. And that's where I was headed. And I knew something, you know, all through that time, I felt like something, you know, really bad was going to happen. And I'd kind of resigned myself that I was going to live a short, good life. And I felt like I would not make it past, you know, 22, 23. And I was okay with that. I just didn't want to end up in, you know, in prison for the rest of my life. And you know, I felt like I was going to either get killed or something was going to happen. I knew something bad was going to happen, and it did. When I was, right before I was about to turn 20, I'd kind of stopped doing all drugs, and I was just drinking every day. And I had a girlfriend, and I was still selling drugs for a living, but we had just went out one night to get some wine or something at the store, and there were some cops in the parking lot, and they started talking to us. And I just got some drugs for somebody, so they came up and they let them search the car, and so they found some like small amount of pot in the car. And the people I was with told them it was me, so they took us to the police station. And I was figuring it was just going to be something, you know, quick and easy. And then you know, I gave them my real name. Finally, they ran my social security, and I heard come back on the radio, it said, you know, John Wesley Hauser, black male, 6'1", you know, wanted for felony murder and armed robbery, and had a few other charges too. You know, it was definitely, I knew something bad was going to happen, and that's what it was. And fortunately it did happen, because otherwise, like I said, I would have ended up dead for sure. So I ended up heading down to, they put me in the city jail for a little bit, and they moved me over to Rice Street. And, you know, I didn't have any bond. And today I'm glad for that, because, you know, even sitting in there, I sat in there for 18 months in Rice Street just waiting for anything. And if anybody's been to Rice Street, it's not a good place. And definitely you don't want to be there for 18 months. But, you know, I sat for about a year, and I still would have got out and done the same thing. I would have went right back to it. And, you know, so fortunately I sat and, you know, didn't do a whole lot of anything for about a year and 3 months. And then in there they had a dorm, like an AA dorm, or, you know, kind of treatment dorm that this guy ran. And I was on the sixth floor, so I was just wanting something different to be able to do something different. So I applied to get in there. They let me in, and even though it was crazy, just because you're in a jail setting, it was like they had meetings every day. You know, they had outside people come in and bring meetings to us. We had, you know, therapy groups and all that stuff, and you know, it was kind of a light exposure. And it was much calmer than the other dorms, and you know, that was kind of my first real exposure where I actually, you know, was open-minded to hear about AA. And you know, so from there, you know, I think I got to the point where I was looking at, I didn't know about the murder charge and armed robbery, so we weren't sure what was going on with that, but we were pretty sure we were going to that was going to get, you know, thrown out, or we were going to go to trial. And the other charge I was looking at was a drug trafficking charge for meth, and that was a 10-year mandatory minimum. So that's what I was expecting to do, just 10 years. I'd come to realize that was just what it was, and I was okay. I'd made peace with that. And, you know, throughout the whole time I was there initially, I struggled, you know, just I was fighting, like, you know, just trying to manage things and, you know, weasel out of stuff and figure out an angle. And, you know, I'd just gotten so frustrated and tired of that. And I think the first honest prayer I ever said in there was, you know, just got down on my knees one night. I think it was about 15 months in. And you said, God, because nothing had happened. I hadn't heard anything from the prosecutor, nothing, no offers, anything. And, you know, I said, I just don't want to do this alone anymore. I'm not asking for a result. I'm not asking to get out of trouble. I just, you know, I just want peace. And then the next day, who knows what this was, but the next day I got a court date, you know, and just nothing had happened up to that point. And then about a month later, they came in and said the evidence was gone from the locker, the money and the drugs that I had on the trafficking case, and they dead docketed it. And then beyond that, they came back and they didn't really have enough evidence to take me to trial. They didn't feel sure about it, so that case got dismissed. I got pushed on the marijuana case, and I'd already had like a couple of probations I hadn't showed up for, so I had to kind of bump around to Cobb County and some places to take care of that. And I ultimately ended up going down the road for you know, a little bit to, you know, to Jackson and then to Phillips State Prison. But you know, when I got to Jackson, they didn't have any books for me to read. And the only book that I could get was a big book, and I was just waiting to ship out. And so I was like, you know, I'll read it, and I read it from cover to cover. And as soon as I finished it, I shipped out. So I just took my time reading it and shipped out to Phillips. And then, you know, from Phillips, I was about to get out, and I was talking to my dad, and I was like, I don't think I need to go to A, you know. So I think we were just kind of thinking about it too much, and I think I'll be all right. And you know, fortunately, I listened to him, and when I was about to get out, the court also kind of gave me an option of either going to a state-run treatment center or a private one. So, you know, I got out, and I went to primary purpose up in Decatur. It was in Decatur at that time. And their halfway house. So, you know, and I guess that's the first time I really gave recovery a chance. And you know, definitely was an amazing thing, because I got in there and I, you know, applied myself, went to meetings, got a sponsor, got honest, went through the steps, and I had, you know, had a long journey. You know, I'd been used to one type of lifestyle, and then, you know, I was working at Kroger for, I think, $5.15 an hour, and, you know, just doing things. But I was as happy as I've ever been. You know, I was, like, extremely grateful just to be out. I'd had, you know, I just didn't want any more of the results I was getting. So I was 22 at that time, and I basically grew up in AA because I was still a child in my mindset and in the way I looked at the world and handled things. You know, I just stayed close. I went to the Triangle Club a lot first, 8111, and I came to the NABA. And, you know, this is where I grew up. I learned how to do everything here. I, you know, learned how to just have basic relationships with men and women, and I learned how to show up places on time, because that was never something I could do before. I learned how to keep my commitments by coming here and making coffee and leading meetings and, you know, volunteering in the kitchen. And you know, I got a good sponsor, and I stuck by him to get me through the steps. And, you know, I stayed that way for about 2 years, and then kind of went off on my own and started sponsoring myself and got a little disconnected. And fortunately, I met a guy over at Biscayne. They're a group that's this band from here, but I will say that they saved my life hands down. It was a complete abandon, and the guy came up to me and told me he was going to be my sponsor, and they set me on a path of, you know, always being a service and always working with others and whatever it took, you know, for the next 2 years of working with them, I was, you know, constantly in service and working with other guys and 12-stepping people. And I credit that to really saving my life and setting me on a path of NAA of something that just wasn't like kind of mediocre, which is what I was doing, which was just showing up to meetings and really worrying about myself. So, you know, it was a really tough group to be in, so I kind of broke away from it a couple years later. But, you know, I stayed sober for a good 15 and a half years. So that was back, I'm 42 now, so I think when I was 34, 35, which like Troy talked about, my first wedding. First and only, you know, I had that, and I'd never, I got married, and then 8 months later, kind of had a devastating break there, and the girl ended up I wasn't the right person for her, she wasn't the right person for me, and she ended up going out on the marriage, and you know, I got through that, but I don't think I ever dealt with it, and I didn't talk about it with anybody, I didn't stay connected here, and. And I think that was kind of the kind of start of me getting back towards relapsing. And I, you know, it was a good couple of years after that where, you know, I was just down in Texas working. I'd started a new business that was doing real well. Like everything was going good. And I was with a friend of mine, and it talks about in the book, like where you just have no mental defense against that first drink. And yeah, 15 and a half years, I picked it back up. And, you know, it was a good night. Nothing happened. You know, we had fun and you know, came back to Atlanta and went back to doing what I was doing. And, but slowly but surely, not slowly but quickly, you know, within a few weeks, I'd kind of gotten back into, you know, partaking a little more. And then, after that, it was full throttle, you know, and, you know, a lot of the stuff I didn't experience when I was, you know, 19, where you bounce back physically quickly, you don't have a lot of responsibilities, you know, like it talks about the four horsemen, the terror, bewilderment, I started missing, you know, entire days at first I would forget, and then I started forgetting, you know, 4 or 5 days at a time, you know, and I started blacking out, and I would come to, you know, in a car or in a conversation with somebody or, you know, I'd gotten a DUI, or not a DUI, but I got lucky and got a reckless drive, and I was driving on the wrong side of the road up there on 85 on the highway, and, I was out in Noonan, because I have a place down in Noonan, so I was out from here to Grantville, which is about 60 miles. I got in the car, I don't remember how I got there. Unfortunately, a bunch of people that were driving on the highway kind of cornered me in and pushed me over. And later on the line, it was good for me because the cop hadn't actually seen me driving or didn't have video of me driving. So I was able to get off with reckless driving because I was drinking GHB and I didn't have any alcohol or anything on my breath. So, you know, but 3 months later, up on 85, I got, you know, pulled over, and I got a DUI that time for doing the same thing. And I got a drug charge because I had some Xanax in the car. And my solution wasn't to stop drinking. It was to pay somebody to drive me around. So that's what I did. I got somebody to drive me around and, you know, and just kept at it. And, you know, I had gotten to the point where I was starting out to have a child at this point, and that was, I think, the only thing that was keeping me somewhat hanging on was I was still coming to AA meetings, even though I was that messed up, and nobody ever told me, you know, don't come back, or, you know, made me feel bad, and I had a child that I had to look out for, and even that was starting to get to where, you know, I would start calling and saying I can't come get him, or, you know, I would take a risk and drive with him, you know, in the car, and just stuff I would never do, you know, if I being sober. And you know, fortunately for me, one thing I learned over time is that I won't stop drinking unless I'm physically stopped. That's either, you know, jail, or I'm too sick to get anything in my body. And you know, I was at home I'd just been there for a couple days, laying around, and I'd gotten really sick one day, I think food poisoning or something, and I was throwing up, and you know, then I felt better the next day, and then I started feeling real bad again, and at one point I couldn't really move. I was so sick, and fortunately my mom was there. I would have probably laid there and died, because what had happened is the day before when I got the food poisoning, I was throwing up and I was inhaling it, and I got some in my lung and had whatever type of pneumonia that is. So my mom was able to get me to the emergency room, and I got admitted and started withdrawal with pneumonia in the hospital. It was like one of the worst experiences I've ever had, just writhing in pain, couldn't sleep because I'd been doing an opiate-like substance too for a little while, so I was going through that withdrawing off of Xanax alcohol, and it was the worst probably 7 days of my life. Couldn't walk to the bathroom, had to crawl, and just was, it was bad. And, I was, even in all that, I was trying to, fortunately my mom sat in the room with me the whole time to watch and make sure nobody came, because I was trying to call somebody to get them to bring me something up there for relief. And fortunately I was able to kind of separate and get a moment of clarity and realize I needed to get back into treatment. So, I checked myself into it's a 6-month program, but I committed to staying for a year. Same place I'd went, to the 3/4 house before, which was Hope Homes, which is just a wonderful place and great people. And, I started my journey on sobriety again. And, this time I knew what I was coming back to. So it was easy to come back, because I knew what AA had to offer, and I was clearly seeing what my will was getting me, which was, I started going to jail again. I started having some pretty serious problems with my family and relationships, and I'd been sober for about 6 months, and I was driving to work one day, and I got there, everything was fine, and I was walking across, like, I have a business up on Jimmy Carter, and we have a bunch of different buildings that are connected. So I was walking across one building, and I saw, like, a black car, and I was like, that's kind of weird, but didn't think about it. So I was walking back, and, a bunch of, like, 20 cops pulled in the parking lot, came in, and it was the FDA. I'm in a business that's highly regulated, so, and I wasn't personally highly regulated when I was using, so that caused me some issues, and, I did some things I shouldn't have done, and now it's time to pay for it. But the one thing I was thinking when they were arresting me sober was that I'm glad I'm not using, because there's no telling what I would have had on me. There's no telling what, state of mind I would have been in. But it's just one of those things where, my consequences this time were a little bit more severe. And, so that's something that happened, I think, I've been sober for about 4 years now, so it happened a while ago, but it's still something that I'm dealing with, and it's still an open case. And I admitted to my guilt and took responsibility, and it could end up with some prison time. But that's one of the things. Being sober has allowed me to stay focused on what's important, and that's what's right in front of me. And when that happened, it was pretty unsettling, but I was able to stay the course, get through the steps, and focus on helping other people, and life has worked out tremendously. My business has grown amazingly, and it's much more stable, and it was a good experience for me, because it showed me the way I was doing things wasn't the right way, and it helped me clean my act up and get, and that was the choice I had, was either to continue what I was doing and go down the tubes or clean things up, and I did that, and I stayed sober through it, and it was probably one of the hardest couple of years, kind of mentally and emotionally, in my life. But but I have a lot to be grateful for today, and no matter what happens, I only have that because of AA, and coming here has been the highlight of that. I've come back to NABA, got involved in the service here. When I first came back, I worked in the kitchen for almost a year, down there at the Saturday breakfast. I got back into sponsoring people, and started, doing all the different things I knew that I needed to do to enlarge my spiritual life inside and outside the rooms. And, I've been rewarded more than I deserve, I can say that for sure. So, for me, AA has been I've got a clear track record of my life with AA and my life without. And my life with AA is much, much better and much calmer and, I can sleep easy at night, don't have to look over my shoulder, and I love this place. NABA has been truly like kind of the one thing. I've been to meetings, because I travel a lot all over, and this place truly is special based on all the meetings I've went to. So that's my story, and I appreciate you guys letting me tell it. Okay.
I've seen you here a number of times in that 8111, but I've never heard you speak. That was amazing. Thanks for sharing that. Okay, Tinsley. We have Tinsley to come up and hand out the chips.
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Wes. That was great. Really great getting to know you through your story. Here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you'd like to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer a white chip. Anybody like to pick up a white chip?
Stuck with me.